So we are getting closer, very close now to the end of this series. And through this series, and again, I just keep kind of putting these chapters out because this is, you know, this is a section that people ought to know. It's 40 through 55, Isaiah 40 through 55. And through these chapters, Isaiah has shared with us what God revealed to him, right? That's kind of what prophets do. Old Testament Israel, which had been chosen by God, not just randomly because, oh, look at these people, aren't they cute, I'm going to take them home. No, because he had a very specific purpose. He had a very specific plan for them. They were chosen in order to do something, right? They were chosen in order to be his special people, which was a privilege that he was going to reveal himself to them in a way that he had not revealed himself to the rest of the world. And there was a purpose in that. It wasn't just that God was lonely. He revealed himself to his special people so that they would be equipped to live according to his will. Okay? And again, not just because God has this tyrannical streak, but because living by his will, they would demonstrate by that fundamentally different and godly way of doing life, they would demonstrate and show the world how good God is and how good living according to his will is, right? Because none of us think that yielding our will to somebody else's will is, there's anything good about that, right? And so God's plan was to show people that the last thing you would ever think of, which is giving up what you want to do what somebody else says, that when that someone else is God, the result is unbelievable. That was God's plan in choosing Israel to be his people. And if they were to have done that, remember one section of this was about, oh, if you had only listened to me, right? If they had actually done that, the nations would have flocked to them in order to learn God's way, in order to share in the blessings of living in God's will. But mixed in with that vision, Isaiah has also shown us that over 1,000 years, given every possible privilege, grace, and advantage and opportunity, they have done nothing but reject his will over and over and over and over again. They have totally failed to live up to their calling, and that time, those 1,000 years of God's patience, that time is now up. Through Isaiah, God says that they will go into exile. The fullness of the curse of Deuteronomy will come upon them. They will experience what it is to be rejected by God for rejecting God. But that rejection will be a genuine experience, but not a final rejection. Their drinking of the fullness of the curse will not be the end, because once God has said that his people will serve him, then his people will serve him one way or another. It must happen. So in a demonstration that nothing is ever too late or too hard for God, he tells them that he will first deliver their physical bodies from the physical exile by raising up Cyrus. And it turns out that that's an advance advertisement, right? Like a movie trailer of what he will do about the real problem. That just as Cyrus delivers their bodies, he will send another greater deliverer who will overturn the real exile, which is the exile from God, who will bring the real freedom, which is not deliverance from slavery in Egypt, it's delivery from the slavery of sin, right? A delivery from the guilt that stands like a wall between them and the God that wants to change their hearts. So how are the sinful people of God that Isaiah sees before him, how are they rescued from their sin? How is it that they are given new hearts that are not only capable but desire to obey God? How is it that they will be transformed in order to fulfill their destiny, right? Destiny is such a dramatic word, but, you know, it fits here. How is it that they will come to that place where they are actually able to serve God, living according to his will, and by that bringing salvation to the nations? And in the second half of this whole section, Isaiah has been showing us that it's going to be through the work of this new servant, like but unlike Cyrus, and about whom we've been hearing ever since chapter 49. We've been told how he appears in the love and power of God himself, that he appears as a representative of what Israel should be, but unlike Israel, he actually listens carefully to God. And in listening to God, he comes to a deep understanding of God's own heart, so that he is able to act faithfully and speak even on God's behalf, accurately representing God's interests as a veritable image of God. He calls out to the disobedient people, offering them a way to return to God and his will for them. But, as Isaiah has already shown us over and over again, they are a stiff-necked, rebellious people. And as they have rejected God, they reject his servant. But even as the nation rejects him, there are certain individuals among the crowd, right? Remember the who among you, who hear his word and respond in trust. They themselves still walk in darkness. They do not see God clearly, but they can see the servant whom he's sent. Their hearts may still be deaf to God's own voice, but they can hear the servant who speaks God's word. And they trust him. And so this new congregation gathers around the rejected servant. And then, like we saw, for the first time in these chapters, this new congregation trusting the servant is addressed as those who pursue the Lord and seek righteousness. They're addressed as those who have the law of the Lord written on their hearts. Right? And we begin to feel like, wow, something really is happening here. Right? And this new congregation that gathers around the servant, they're encouraged to patiently bear rejection together with the servant and to join him in his work of testifying to the faithfulness of God and thus bring salvation to the rest of the world. And they're promised that as they share in his rejection and as they share in his work, so they will also eventually share in his vindication and glorification. But through all of that story that Isaiah's been sharing with us, in all of this, the center has remained dark. Isaiah has carefully sidestepped that which we would most like to know. What will this all-wise and all-powerful servant, what will this one who's been addressed as the arm of the Lord, what will he actually do? How does he overthrow powers as unconquerable as sin and death in order to lead captive humanity into eternal freedom? Right? What does the climactic moment of God's eternal plan look like when it finally comes? What does the great servant do that can change the hearts of God's people in a way that nothing before has ever been able to do? When God reaches the climax of his plan for all the ages, and in that gives the ultimate revelation of his own love, his own wisdom, and his own power, when the very nature of God in its essence is revealed to the cosmos, what does that look like? Today's passage, one of the most famous and familiar in all of the Old Testament, brings us to that climax. Here, Isaiah finally shows us what the work of this servant really is. Not what motivates him, we've been told about that. Not what the results will be, we've been told a lot about that. But we're told what it is he actually does, in what his service to God actually consists. Here we see how he makes a servant people for God out of sinners. The passage is clearly constructed as a unit, although it crosses chapter lines. Remember that the chapters were added just hugely, hugely late, very, very recently in the big picture. So this does cross the chapter lines, but it's very clearly one cohesive unit in Isaiah's writing because it's built in five clear stanzas of three verses each, where there's a cohesive idea or motif in each of the five stanzas. So the first stanza is the last part of chapter 52, verses 13 through 15. And the main motif of the first stanza is astonishment. Okay? When God makes the climactic move of all history to exalt and glorify the one human being who has actually done his will, all of humanity is taken aback. Seeing what they would not have expected, seeing what they would have never believed. From 52:13. See, my servant will act wisely. He will be raised and lifted up and highly exalted. The ancient world thought they knew what it looks like to see a human being exalted, lifted up. Okay? But when God does it, this is the result. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, probably referring back to we were already told how the chosen people were astonished at him and rejected him, what's happening now is being compared to that. Just as there were many who were appalled at him, his appearance was so disfigured beyond that of any man, and his form marred beyond human likeness, so will he sprinkle many nations. Now, a quick note about that. If you look in the footnotes of the NIV, it suggests that this could have also been translated as many nations will marvel at him. And it's sometimes in the New Testament, especially in the Old Testament, there are places that it's very hard to determine how it should be translated. And in those cases, context is usually the best guide. And here, in my view, context strongly suggests the alternate reading that's in the footnotes of the NIV. So here, I would ask you to ride along with me as we set sprinkle aside and read, so many nations will marvel at him, be astonished, right? And kings will shut their mouths because of him, right? Not in awe, but in like, don't know what to make of what they're seeing. For what they were not told, they will see, and what they have not heard, they will understand. So there are a couple of things here, like the sprinkle marvel question that I said, that are not clear, right? But there is stuff here that is very clear, right? First, God says that he will now reveal his servant. This servant who's been a mystery, he says, now I'm going to bring him out and people are going to see him for who he is. God reveals his servant and he says that his servant will be successful. God brings out his secret weapon to overturn a world of sin. God brings out his final solution who will actually put the entire universe back on track. The obedient servant will be lifted up, will be shown for who he is, and he will carry the day. So, we've all seen movies. We know what it looks like, right? When the battered hero finally reaches down deep and finds that last ounce and then comes through, right? It's glorious. The streets are lined with people cheering. Rocky gets back up off the mat. Do young people even know who Rocky is? Rocky gets back up off the mat, and the crowd goes wild, right? We know what the scene looks like when the hero finally comes through. And so here, do the people of the world line the streets cheering this amazing conqueror for God who appears in the glory of God to make all things right? No. When God shows ultimate victory, the people of the world respond the same way that the disobedient people of God responded. They recoil in horror. We're told that in the same way that God's people thought him to be absolutely without any attraction, the rest of the nations likewise marvel and are dumbfounded. They have nothing to say when God trots out the great universe-transforming champion. He looks like a million other despised and worthless commoners. We have a great example of this, and I'm not saying that this is a prophecy of that. I'm saying that what Isaiah is talking about, we see a good example of in Pilate. He's been hearing about this miracle-working man of God. He's been hearing about the one that the high priests are warning him that he could rival Caesar. But when Pilate sees him, he's astonished. He says, "Is this a joke? Is this who your God sends up against Caesar? I'll put my money on Caesar." And here the whole world says, "This is who your God puts up against sin and death? I'll put my money on sin and death." When God reveals what it is that his servant will do, when God does it, the world just can't make any sense of it. But again, Isaiah hasn't shown us what it actually is. The primary idea of the second stanza is that the servant is utterly contemptible, despised and rejected by everyone, not even treated with basic human dignity, because there's nothing in him that asks for any respect, nothing that asks or appears to deserve any dignity. This is 53:1-3. "Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? He grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him, nothing in his appearance that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and familiar with suffering. Like one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not." First of all, Isaiah observes, and kind of continuing the thought from the first stanza, that no one's going to believe what he has to say. No one's going to believe that God's answer to the need of the world looks like this. Then he says that the servant was not worth noticing. And kind of as a picture of that, he says, he grew up before him like a tender shoot, right? And those words sound endearing, okay? My daughter-in-law, Ellen, goes to Lowe's or Home Depot, and she actually like picks up off the floor the little half-dead, dried-up fragments that have broken off the houseplants, and she takes them home and plants them and nurses them to health, and they thrive, okay? Their house is absolutely full of hundreds of houseplants, all on the cheap, right? Which is totally Ellen's way, right? It is endearing, okay? We Americans love to root for the underdog, right? That's kind of stuff that resonates with us, right? And so we picture, I've always had this tendency, I think we tend to read, he grew up like a tender shoot, right? And it's like, oh, so precious, right? Hold Isla up again, right? Right? And, oh, look, the tender little child, right? But that's not what Isaiah is saying here, okay? What he's actually referring to is the trashy little suckers that grow off the bottom of a tree, right? Particularly maples, have you noticed this? Right at the bottom of a maple, hemlocks do this as well. You cut down a hemlock, and then the roots, all of a sudden you have a little hemlocks popping up all over the place, and it's just trash, right? Or your nice maple tree in the backyard, and then it has all these little mini trees sprouting off the bottom. And every year you have to go back and cut them back. And every time you cut one, it's like a hydra. Three more spring out the following year, right? That's what Isaiah is saying that he's like. Great men, kings and conquerors, the ones that move history forward, are consistently pictured as great trees in the Bible, like the cedars of Lebanon or the oaks of Bashan, the tree that Nebuchadnezzar dreamt of. But when God's greatest answer to the need of the world arrives, he's worse than a shrub. He's trash. He's the kind of thing that when you see him, you think, wow, the yard would look really nice if we could get rid of that. And therefore, he was despised by all. Okay? Now, despise doesn't mean what we use it to mean now. Okay? Nowadays, to despise means to hate with a strong passion. Right? The way you might feel about mayonnaise. Right? I have strong feelings about mayonnaise. Right? I despise the vile substance. Right? That's how we use despise nowadays. But originally, and here, it means to think nothing of, to pass off or to treat as utterly unimportant. Okay? When I was a kid, a penny was still worth picking up. I don't think many people bother now. Unless it's some sort of nostalgia. Ooh, good luck. Find a penny, pick it up. Put it in your pocket, have good luck, or whatever the rhyme was. I don't remember, actually. A penny, you wouldn't bother with, right? It's despised. That's what the word means. He was worthless. Not hated, necessarily. Just, why bother? Surely this is not important. And because the world is the way it is, people who count for nothing suffer. People who can be overlooked and can be treated without dignity are simply used by those who are worth more. You see this everywhere if you have any eyes whatsoever to see it. And Isaiah here is saying that the servant is the greatest example of that. He appears as the lowest of the low, and so he is considered as nothing by all, and so he suffers at the hands of all. Wherever he turns, he finds only rejection and suffering. The third stanza, verses 4 through 6, is the center one of the five stanzas. And so it's where we actually find the central idea, where we find the hinge that the whole thing turns on. All who saw his suffering thought, surely this man is cursed by God. Surely this man suffers as he does for his own wickedness. And we don't do, I'm kind of off on a side trail here, but you know, we don't consciously think that way anymore, but we do that very, very same thing. We see somebody suffering, and there's something in us that immediately suggests that they brought it on themselves. And here, they're partially right. His suffering is caused by God. But the central idea, when we read it here, is that he suffers punishment from God, but not for his own sins, for ours. Because all of us, like sheep, have wandered from God's will. Verses 4 through 6. Surely he took up our infirmities and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken by God, smitten by him, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. We all, like sheep, have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. You really almost don't want to say much about this. Rather, just kind of take off your shoes and worship. There are people who call themselves Christian, and I don't mean that there are people who call themselves Christian, and I will say many of them probably really are, because people can genuinely experience God's grace and still hold some pretty nutty ideas. But there are people who deny that Jesus' death on the cross was a sacrifice for our sin, and try to find the heart of Christianity in something else. There are people who do not believe that when Jesus went to the cross, they believe he went to the cross, they believe he was innocent, they believe all these other things, but they reject the idea that God was laying on him punishment that our disobedience requires from a just God who is obligated by his own nature to uphold righteousness and punish sin. But this could not be more clear. The center stanza of the climax of this whole section, and Isaiah says, like seven different times in these three verses, he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him. By his wounds, we are healed. Right? In all of this, the main points are, one, our sin requires punishment. And yes, the Bible says over and over again that God is forgiving and all this. But that doesn't negate this reality. If this was not a reality, if it was not real that our sins require punishment, if the only truth was God is love and forgives sin, then the Bible would be this big. It would be a very simple story. The whole message would simply be, there is now no condemnation. Hard stop. Go home. One of the reasons that the Bible is like not very simple is because the problem is really big and it's really hard to figure out a way. And anything short of God's own wisdom, God's own power, God's own love simply would not find a way at all. The first thing here is that our sin actually deserves, requires punishment. Justice is real. It's immutable, whichever you prefer, because it is part of the very nature of God. But that punishment, here Isaiah is perfectly clear, falls not on us, the guilty, but on God's servant. And the third thing that he is perfectly clear about here is that because the punishment for our sin falls on God's servant, we are restored to wholeness. That we come out okay because of what happens to the servant in our place. Isaiah compares us to sheep who are utterly unable to look after themselves, who can do nothing for themselves except get themselves into trouble. And as often as not, trouble that will cost them their lives. But God took that trouble and laid it on his servant. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. The fourth stanza is built around the idea that the servant undergoes all of this suffering, both innocently and willingly. This is verses 7 through 9. He was oppressed and afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. He was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and as a sheep before her shearers is silent, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and who can speak of his descendants? For he was cut off from the land of the living. For the transgression of my people he was stricken. He was assigned a grave with the wicked and with the rich in his death, though he had done no violence, nor was any deceit in his mouth. Immediately after comparing us to sheep in the worst way, now the servant is compared to a sheep in the best way. If we are like sheep in our waywardness and tendency to create problems for ourselves, he is like a sheep in his innocence and his harmlessness. Now, seeing humanity and the servant both described as sheep does not teach that the divine Messiah, the arm of the Lord, is actually a true and full human being. But once we know that from the clearer revelation of the New Testament, then it's interesting to look back here and see that both we and he are sheep together. The only difference being that we embody the worst of what that means and he the best. We have unfortunately shown the world the worst of what it means to be a human being. While Jesus shows us the very best of what it is to be a human. But again, here we also see his innocence. Unlike us, he has done nothing to deserve this suffering. He was stricken by God because nothing happens without God, but it was for nothing that he had done. This would be the ultimate injustice. And there are many people who mock Christian belief precisely on this, that you claim that your God is just, that your God holds the wicked accountable and delivers the innocent, and yet at the very center of your story, at the very center of your belief, you have God punishing the innocent, condemning the innocent to death in order to let the guilty go free, breaking his own word. Because in the Old Testament, God said, you shall not let the guilty go free, and you shall not punish the innocent. And here you have your God being utterly unjust and also breaking his own word, which you constantly insist he cannot do. This would be the ultimate injustice. This would be what people claim it is, except for the fact that together with his innocence, we have here the fact that he willingly submits to this. This is the part that argument misses. As already described, this servant has listened to God and has come to understand, has come to know God's heart. Knowing God as he really is, he has actually come to share in God's heart. So that just as God has willingly suffered his people's sins for centuries in patience and in long suffering, so the godlike servant also willingly steps forward in love to bear the pain, the shame, the grief and the horror of his people's sins. God is willing to do this in his love, and the servant sharing that love willingly steps forward to participate in God's plan. The motif of the final fifth stanza is the results, which is the flourishing of God's plan for humanity. This is verses 10 through 12. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And though, again here, the word though probably should have been translated when. Okay, and without going into a lot of how Hebrew works, a very few words do a lot of different things. And here the idea is probably when. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him and cause him to suffer. And when the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, he will see his offspring and prolong his days, and the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, incidentally, that's the context that I think argues for when. These two thoughts are parallel. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. By his knowledge, my righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will give him a portion among the great, and he will divide the spoils with the strong, because he poured out his life unto death and was numbered with the transgressors. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. The word of God for the people of God. So here, the idea with that, when his life is made a guilt offering, right? He will see success, prolong his days, have offspring, the will of the Lord will prosper in his hand. After the suffering of his soul, he sees the light of life and is satisfied, makes many righteous, right? Because he suffered and bore their iniquities, therefore I give him a portion among the great, and he'll divide the spoils. Because he poured out his life unto death, he bore the sins of many and made intercession. Right? So all through here, it's first this, but then because of this, this. Right? This is a great parallel to the New Testament passage in, I should be able to nail it, I believe Philippians 2. Right? He emptied himself, the down all the way down and the all the way back up passage. Causing the servant to suffer and be crushed under the load of humanity's accumulated sin, right, was the will of a good, wise, loving God. To crush, to cause suffering, to punish, was the will of a good, wise, and loving God. And the whole world thinks we're insane. But this evil was the will of a good, wise, and loving God, because God and his servant alone could see what the result would be. John Thorpe once shared how his daughter broke her leg in Bangladesh and how he had to hold her still while the doctor caused tremendous pain setting the bone. His wisdom, greater than hers, understood that a good and loving father needed to inflict the pain. So what is the result when the Lord makes his life a guilt offering? The one who was said to die childless, back in verse 8, now has offspring filling the world, as was promised to Abraham. Although put to death, he now prolongs his days, an expression of blessing. The will of God was that all the world should be set right, and that will prospers in his hands. He suffers even to the very cost of his life, but then somehow sees the light of life and is satisfied, right? And that idea of being satisfied, that's like similar to the shalom peace of things being the way they're supposed to be. Everything being the way it's supposed to be. He's deeply gratified in the knowledge that by his suffering, the many, not just the few who trusted him in the rejection, but now the many that have been referred to so many times as kind of the problem through these chapters, now the many who rejected him are made righteous. He's vindicated and given the place of highest honor, right? The firstborn of all creation, because he was willing to pour out his life unto death, being numbered as one of us transgressors, bearing the sins of many, and thereby making intercession, which incidentally we use to say, say prayers for people, but that's not the root idea. To intercede is to step in between two parties. Here he makes intercession, not in the sense that he's praying for us now in heaven, other passages do say that, but here he makes intercession by stepping in between us and God. Stepping in between the guilty people and the angry God who just must hold humanity accountable. And he steps in place as a true human being so that all that humanity deserves falls on humanity. That's how he makes intercession. This is how sinners become the servants of God. This is how God finally creates for himself a people with transformed hearts who are no longer blind and deaf, but now have hearts that can know him, that can love him, hearts that now can obey him, so that the world sees in them how good the will of God is. We are restored to our right place before God, the place that we were created for. We are restored to our high calling as human beings, living out the image of God. We are restored by Jesus, the Christ, dying in our place, stricken on the cross for our sin. Amen.